Theodore Roosevelt, for example, made a reputation as a trust buster, a politician who opposed monopolies. But two men in the service of multimillionaire J.P. Morgan made private deals with Roosevelt to make sure that trust busting wouldn't go too far. Roosevelt's advisors were industrialists and bankers, not unionists and workers. The progressive movement had some leaders who were honest reformers, and others, like Roosevelt, who were only disguised as progressives. In reality, they were conservatives, opposed to change and concerned with preserving the balance of power and wealth. Both kinds of progressives saw their mission as fending off socialism. They felt that by improving conditions for the masses, they could prevent what one progressive called the menace of socialism. The Socialist Party was on the rise. In 1910, Victor Berger became the first socialist elected to the U.S. Congress. In 1911, there were 73 socialist mayors and 1,200 socialists in other city and town offices. Newspapers talked about the rising tide of socialism. The progressives' goal was to save capitalism by repairing its worst problems. In this way, they thought, they could end the growing class war that pitted workers against the economic and political elites. But a strike of Colorado coal miners that began in September 1913 turned into one of the most bitter and violent battles in that war. After a union organizer was murdered, 11,000 miners went on strike. The Rockefeller family, which owned the mine, sent detectives with machine guns to raid the strikers' camps. The strikers fought to keep out strikebreakers and to keep the mines from opening. When the governor called on National Guard troops to destroy the strike, the Rockefellers paid the National Guard's wages. Violent battles, betrayals, and massacres followed. In April 1914, the bodies of 13 children and women were found in a pit, killed by a fire set by the National Guardsmen. The news spread across the country. Strikes, demonstrations, and protests broke out everywhere. President Woodrow Wilson finally sent in federal troops to crush the strike. 66 men, women, and children had died. No soldier or mine guard was charged with a crime. Colorado's ferocious class conflict was felt all over the land. Whatever reforms had been passed, whatever new laws were on the books, the threat of class rebellion remained, and unemployment and hard times were growing. Could patriotism and the military spirit cover up class struggle? The nation was about to find out. In 4 months, World War I would begin in Europe. Chapter 14. World War I. The nations of Europe went to war in the late summer of 1914. The conflict that we now called World War I would drag on for 4 years. 10 million people would die on its battlefields. 20 million more would die of hunger and disease related to the war. And no one has ever been able to show that the war brought any gain for humanity that would be worth a single life. At the time, socialists called it an imperialist war, a war fought in the service of empire building by nations that wanted to increase their power by controlling territory or resources. The advanced capitalist nations of Europe fought over boundaries such as the region of Alsace-Lorraine, claimed by both France and Germany. They fought over colonies in Africa, and they fought over spheres of influence, areas in Eastern Europe and the Middle East that were not claimed openly as colonies, but still came under the protection and control of some European nation. Blood and money. Many nations joined the war on one side or the other, but the main enemies were Germany on one side and the Allies, France and Great Britain, on the other. The killing started very fast and on a very large scale. In one early battle in France, each side had 500,000 casualties. Almost the entire British army from before the war was wiped out in the first 3 months of fighting. The battle lines were drawn across France. For 3 years, they barely moved. Men spent months in filthy, disease-ridden trenches. Each side would push forward, then be pushed back, then push forward again for a few yards or a few miles while the corpses piled up. In 1916, the Germans tried to break through the lines at a place called Verdun. The British and French counterattacked and lost 600,000 men. The people of France and Britain were not told the full numbers of dead and wounded. When a German attack on the Somme River caused 300,000 British casualties in the last year of the war, London newspapers told readers, "Be cheerful, write encouragingly to friends at the front." The same thing was true in Germany. The true horror of the war was kept from the people. On days when men were being blown apart in the thousands by machine guns and artillery shells, the official war report said, "All quiet on the Western Front." German writer Erich Maria Remarque later used that phrase as the title of his great novel about the war. Into this pit of death and deception came the United States in 1917. Earlier, President Woodrow Wilson had promised that the United States would keep out of the war. But the question of shipping in the North Atlantic Ocean drew the United States into the fight. In 1915, a German submarine had torpedoed and sunk a British liner, the Lusitania, on its way from North America to Britain. Nearly 1,200 people, including 124 Americans, died. The United States claimed that the Lusitania was carrying civilian passengers and innocent cargo, and that the German attack was a monstrous atrocity. In truth, the Lusitania was heavily armed. She carried thousands of cases of ammunition for the British. False cargo records hid this fact, and the British and American governments lied about the cargo. Then, in April 1917, the Germans warned that their submarines would sink any ships that were carrying supplies to their enemies. This included the United States, which had been shipping huge amounts of war materials to Germany's enemies. The war in Europe had been good for American business. A serious economic decline had hit the country in 1914. But things turned around when Americans began manufacturing war materials to sell to the Allies, mainly to Britain. By the time the Germans issued their warning about shipping, the United States had sold $2 billion worth of goods to the Allies. American prosperity was now tied to England's war. President Wilson said that he must stand by the right of Americans to travel on merchant ships in the war zone, and Congress declared war on Germany. Wilson called it a war to end all wars and to make the world safe for democracy. These rousing words did not inspire Americans to enlist in the armed forces. 1 million men were needed, but in the first 6 weeks, only 73,000 volunteered. Congress authorized a draft to compel men into service. It also set up a committee on public information. That committee's job was to convince Americans that the war was right. The radical response. The government wanted to discourage dissent and criticism of the war. It passed a law called the Espionage Act. The title makes it seem like a law against spying. But one part of the law called for up to 20 years in prison for anyone who refused to serve in the armed forces or even tried to convince others not to enlist. The act was used to imprison Americans who spoke or wrote against the war. About 900 people went to prison under the Espionage Act. One of them was a Philadelphia socialist named Charles Schenck. 2 months after the act became law, Schenck was sentenced to jail for printing and distributing 15,000 leaflets against the draft and the war. He appealed the verdict, claiming that the act violated his First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and freedom of the press. The case went to the Supreme Court. All 9 justices agreed. The court decided against Schenck. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said that even the strict protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater causing panic. This was a clever comparison. Few people would think that someone should be allowed to get away with shouting fire in a crowded theater and causing a dangerous panic. But did that example fit criticism of the war? Socialist Eugene Debs was also involved in a case before the Supreme Court. After visiting 3 socialists who were in prison for opposing the draft, he made a fiery anti-war speech in the street. "They tell us that we live in a great free republic, that our institutions are democratic, that we are a free and self-governing people. That is too much, even for a joke. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder, and that is war in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles." Debs was arrested for violating the Espionage Act. At his trial, he declared, "I have been accused of obstructing the war. I admit it. Gentlemen, I abhor war." The judge, in turn, spoke harshly about those who would strike the sword from the hand of his nation while she is engaged in defending herself against a foreign and brutal power. He sentenced Debs to 10 years in prison. Several years later, after the war was over, President Warren Harding released Debs from prison. The press worked with the government to create an atmosphere of fear for anyone who dared to criticize the war. One publication asked its readers to turn in any published material they saw that seemed seditious or disloyal to the country. Men joined the American Vigilante Patrol to put an end to seditious street oratory, basically to prevent anti-war speechmaking. The U.S. Post Office took away the mailing privileges of newspapers and magazines that published anti-war articles. The Committee on Public Information tried to turn people into spies and informers against each other. It urged citizens to report the man who spreads pessimistic stories, report him to the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice sponsored the American Protective League in 600 towns. Its members were bankers and leading businessmen. The League seized other people's mail, broke into their homes and offices, and claimed to find 3 million cases of disloyalty. In 1918, the Attorney General of the United States declared, "It is safe to say that never in its history has this country been so thoroughly policed." Why these huge efforts? Because Americans were refusing to fight in the war. Senator Thomas Hardwick of Georgia described general and widespread opposition on the part of many thousands to the enactment of the draft law. Before the war was over, more than 250,000 men were classified as draft evaders, people who refused to be drafted or used trickery or self-mutilation to avoid the draft. The Socialist Party had been against entering the war from the start. The day after Congress declared war, the Socialists held an emergency meeting and called the declaration a crime against the people of the United States. Some well-known Socialists, including writers Upton Sinclair and Jack London, supported the war after the United States entered it. Most Socialists, though, continued to oppose the war. Some paid a heavy price for expressing their opinions. In Oklahoma, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, planned a march on Washington for people from across the country who objected to the draft. Before the march, union members were arrested. 450 people accused of rebellion were put in the state penitentiary. Across the country in Boston, 8,000 socialists and unionists at an anti-war march were attacked by soldiers and sailors acting on their officers' orders. Just before the United States declared war, the IWW newspaper had said, "Capitalists of America, we will fight against you, not for you." Now the war gave the government its chance to destroy the radical union. In September 1917, Department of Justice agents raided 48 IWW meeting halls across the country, seizing letters and literature. The following April, 101 leaders of the union went on trial for opposing the draft and encouraging soldiers to desert. One of them told the court, "You ask me why the IWW is not patriotic to the United States. If you were a bum without a blanket, if you had left your wife and kids when you went west for a job and had never located them since, if your job had never kept you long enough in a place to qualify you to vote, if every person who represented law and order and the nation beat you up, how in hell do you expect a man to be patriotic? This war is a businessman's war." All of the IWW prisoners were found guilty. Bill Haywood and other key leaders were sentenced to 20 years in prison. The rest received shorter sentences. Haywood fled to Russia, where a socialist revolution was taking place. The IWW in the United States was shattered. After the fighting, the war ended in November 1918. 50,000 American soldiers had died. But when the war was over, the establishment, the political and capitalist elites that ran the nation, still feared socialism. The conflict between Democrats and Republicans was less important than the threat of radical change. The government had a new tool to fight that threat. Near the end of the war, Congress had passed a law that let the government deport any alien who opposed organized government or who approved of the destruction of property. An alien was an immigrant who was not a U.S. citizen. Deporting meant removing from the country. In 1919 and 1920, the government rounded up more than 4,000 aliens, including anarchist Emma Goldman. Eventually, they were deported to their birth countries. An anarchist named Andrea Salcedo was held for 2 months in FBI offices in New York City. He wasn't allowed to contact family, friends, or lawyers. Then his crushed body was found on the pavement. The FBI said he had committed suicide by jumping from a window. Two Boston anarchists, friends of Salcedo, learned of his death and began carrying guns. They were arrested and charged with a holdup and murder that had happened 2 weeks earlier. Their names were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. Sacco and Vanzetti were found guilty. They spent 7 years in jail while their cases were appealed to higher courts. All over the world, people became involved in the case. Many believed that Sacco and Vanzetti had been found guilty just because they were anarchists and foreigners. The trial record and other circumstances make it look as though this were true. In August 1927, the two men were executed. The establishment had tried to silence the voices of dissent. Reforms had been made. War had been used to promote patriotism and crush criticism. The courts and jails had made it clear that certain ideas, certain kinds of resistance were not permitted. But still, even from the prison cells, the message was going out. In the United States, a society that was supposed to be without classes, the class war was going on. Chapter 15. Hard Times. It was February 1919. The war had ended in Europe just a few months before. The world was in the grip of an influenza epidemic that would claim 500,000 American lives and millions more worldwide. In the United States, the leaders of the industrial workers of the world were in jail. But their dream was about to become a reality in Seattle, Washington. Strikes by a single union or a single kind of worker could get results. But the IWW felt that a general strike, with all kinds of workers walking off their jobs together, would make a stronger statement. In Seattle, after shipyard workers went on strike for higher wages, more than 100 other unions voted to strike as well. A walkout of 100,000 working people brought the city to a halt. The strikers kept vital services going. Firefighters stayed on the job and milk stations were set up in neighborhoods to deliver milk to families. The strike lasted for 5 days and was peaceful. In fact, during those 5 days, the city had less crime than usual. But after the strike, the authorities raided Socialist Party headquarters. 39 members of the IWW went to jail as ringleaders of anarchy. Why did the government react this way to the strike? Maybe the answer lies in a statement by Seattle's mayor. The general strike as practiced in Seattle is of itself the weapon of revolution, all the more dangerous because quiet. To succeed, it must suspend everything, stop the entire life stream of a community. That is to say, it puts the government out of operation. The general strike made the authorities feel powerless. It seemed to threaten the whole economic and political system of society. Seattle's general strike was just one of many large strikes across the United States in 1919. These labor actions were part of a wave of rebellions around the world, from the communist revolution against royal rule in Russia to a strike by railway workers in England. Ordinary people were rising up, making their voices heard and bringing about change. A writer for The Nation magazine said, "The common man, losing faith in the old leadership, has experienced a new self-confidence." The truth about the 20s. When the 1920s started, the wave of rebellion had died down in the United States. The IWW was destroyed. The Socialist Party was falling apart. Strikes were beaten down by force. The economy was doing just well enough for just enough people to prevent mass rebellion. The 1920s are sometimes called the Roaring Twenties or the Jazz Age, a time of prosperity and fun. There was some truth to that picture. Unemployment was down and the general level of workers' wages went up. People could buy new gadgets such as automobiles, radios, and refrigerators. Millions of people were not doing badly. But most of the wealth was in the hands of a few people at the top of society's pyramid. At the bottom of the pyramid were the black and white tenant farmers living in poverty in the countryside, and the immigrant families in the cities who could not find work or could not earn enough for basic needs. In New York City alone, 2 million people lived in tenement buildings that were known to be unsafe because of fire danger. 14 million immigrants had come to the United States between 1900 and 1920. In 1924, Congress passed an immigration law that put an end to this flood. The new law favored the immigration of white people from English and German backgrounds. Immigration of Southern Europeans, Slavs, and Jews was severely limited, and only 100 people a year could come from China or any African country. Racial hatred and violence were everywhere. The Ku Klux Klan came back in the 1920s, and it spread into the North. By 1924, it had 4.5 million members. After a long struggle, women had finally won the right to vote in national elections in 1920. Yet voting was still an upper-class and middle-class activity, and the new women voters favored the same old political parties as other voters. Labor unrest may have calmed for a time, but it had not faded away. With the Socialist Party weakened, a Communist Party formed in the United States. Communists were involved in many labor struggles, including huge textile strikes in Tennessee and the Carolinas in early 1929. The Great Depression. During the 1920s, the American economy seemed healthy, even booming. Prices for stocks, which are shares of ownership in corporations, rose higher than ever. Many people thought that the value of stocks would just keep going up. They invested their money by buying stocks, and they borrowed money from banks to buy still more stocks. The banks invested in stocks too, using the money that customers had deposited. In 1929, the boom ended with a crash. When the value of stock started to drop, people started selling their stocks in a panic. This made the value drop even faster. Banks could not collect the loans that people had taken to buy stocks, and people could not withdraw their money from banks that had invested it and lost it. Both the stock market and the banking system spiraled swiftly downward, triggering a severe crisis in the economy. The United States had entered the Great Depression. The economy was stunned, barely moving. More than 5,000 banks closed. Thousands of businesses closed too. Businesses that managed to stay open laid off some workers and cut the wages of other workers again and again. By 1933, perhaps as many as 15 million people were out of work. A quarter to a third of the nation's workforce could not find jobs. There were millions of tons of food in the country, but it was not profitable to ship it or sell it, so people went hungry